counties opt in to public health funding. Brad Chambers makes big moves, plus private polling in the gubernatorial race, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 8th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, all but six of Indiana's 92 counties opted to take new funding from the state under this year's public health system overhaul legislation. That means nearly 96% of Hoosiers will have access to core public health services provided by those counties. The new state budget delivered $75 million this fiscal year and $150 million next year in new public health funding for counties, up from just about $7 million the last couple of decades. To get the money, counties had to agree to provide about two dozen core services, everything from food and sanitary inspections to child and maternal health services and preventative care for diabetes and obesity. But it was entirely voluntary. County elected officials had to decide whether to take the money and provide the services. And many believe that as much as a third of the state or more would refuse to take the money, at least initially. But by the September 1st deadline, 86 of 92 counties opted in for the first year of funding, which also means that $75 million will be stretched a little thinner. Are you surprised so many counties opted in to the new public health funding? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Ann Delaney. Republican, Chris Mitchum. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, how big a surprise is it? 86 out of 92?
I think it's wonderful. I mean, it may be a little surprising, but it's very gratifying. I think it's a testament to the fact that former Senator Luke Kennelly and Dr. Box lobbied this so hard to get it passed and get it implemented. And of the six counties, five of them are rural, and they still have an opportunity to get in, and I hope they will. And Johnson County ought to rethink their decision that everything's perfect in Johnson County, because the indices of health for Indiana are awful. I mean, between smoking and obesity and diabetes and all of these issues that we have, this is an important first step. And it is only the first step, but it's a good first step, and they ought to take advantage of it, because heaven knows we need it.
Yeah, at least one of the more rural counties said, our personnel is so in flux, we couldn't implement the programs even if we got the money.
They can opt in
at that point. How surprising and gratifying, considering the whole process that this went through to get to become law. How surprising and gratifying is it that so many counties opted in?
Yeah, it was definitely a process, because even when this bill was first introduced, it looked quite a bit different than what it did at the end point. At certain points during the legislative process, they added to the list of what core services were. They kind of specified how much certain money should go to certain services. And I think the really big one that kind of cured a lot of fears was they added in a provision where you can opt out of this at any time. And to Ann's point, I hope nobody does, because this is a really good point. You're getting local government buy-in into a public health system funding that was pretty low funded before this. So a lot of credit goes to Senator Ed Charbonneau, Representative Barrett, for not only controlling their caucuses and kind of easing a lot of those fears, but continuing to listen to concerns, adopt amendments to get it to where it was, where it's obviously a really big success as of now.
And, Ann pointed out the lobbying that was done all through the process by former Senator Luke Kennelly, certainly a fairly conservative guy when it comes to spending money. And if he thought there was a need, boy, oh, boy. He and Dr. Box, not just lobbying lawmakers. I mean, they went around the state for months, talked to local officials, local public health officials, local elected officials. Is that maybe why this shouldn't have been surprising?
Well, being a good fiscal steward and appreciating science and medicine are not mutually exclusive.
Absolutely
not. Let's point that out. It's great that 86 counties stepped up. It's tragic that the others didn't. You look at funding in this state, and we hear all the time that your opportunity or the services rendered to you shouldn't be determined by your zip code. Well, normally that's in the education context. Well, guess what? This is heavily affected by your zip code, or in this case, your county boundaries. Because if you look at funding on the state level, you know, nationally, what is it, $55 on average per capita in the state. But it ranges from 83 in Marion County here, which is the highest, down to, I think, $1.25 per capita. So you cannot tell me that you're getting an equal opportunity to thrive and survive in the face of many health challenges and maladies if you're living in one of those counties. And we should point out, I believe it was your reporting, Nikki, that said that I think $15 was the top funding level of any of those sort of the outliers, yeah, we'll call them. Yeah. And I've said before, and I say this only half in jest, I think one impediment is by calling it public health, which is what it's been called for a century. But somebody somewhere, they hear the word public, and it must just trigger some strange Pavlovian response where they think it's a road to communism and universal.
For a lot of the people who, as this became law and they looked ahead towards whether counties are going to opt in or not, a lot of the thought was maybe as much as a third won't opt in for mostly political reasons. Well, that turned out largely not to be true.
Yeah, somehow it became like a people thought it was all about vaccines.
COVID,
I mean,
yeah.
public
yeah.
health,
state
that
health
phrase means more than vaccinations or immunizations. It's a whole host of services, whether it be about obesity programs or helping, you know, low-income mothers deal with infants.
You know, it's but it gets tied up in needle sharing,
food,
condom distribution, those types of things. Which
food services are clean. I mean, there's so many public health programs that exist that aren't immunization. And I think once people started thinking more holistically, they made good decisions.
I think that's particularly important in the more rural counties, which are doctor deserts and will continue to be with the export of doctors from Indiana because of their abortion restrictions. So I think it's really important that they tie into something, whether it's the public health agency in the county or something, that they know they can go get services.
They have clinics on breast cancer treatment.
Well, let me direct one more question to you, which was, so in talking to Luke Kenley a couple months ago, before we started seeing all of the counties who opt in. His fear was $75 million. That's a huge start. But if everybody or almost everybody opts in, that's not going to be nearly as much money as they might need, especially when they're going to have to go back to lawmakers in a little over a year, and say, okay, we need more money now.
Yeah.
We need to
re-up
this
program.
Well,
there was one fear there toward the end when they were negotiating. One of the reasons that the Holcomb administration dropped down their first year ask was under the understanding that not all the counties would, you know, sign on immediately. So at least for the first year, it probably won't be as fully robust as they had hoped.
Yeah.
But the second year has $150 million. And so.
Well, keep in mind
the good news too, in terms of again making that case to lawmakers that this is something worth continuing to invest in, is 86 of 92 counties said yes.
Well, and
this is something we want.
They'll have results. Yes. They'll have people coming forward saying it's a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, $75 million is a big chunk. Great place to start. 150 second year, even better. But think where the commission you talked earlier. You started by lauding and justifiably so. This was way down. The ask was way down from what Luke Kenley and Dr.
Like
Box suggested.
Yeah. But even at the end, there was an appetite to add more money to this because you saw even a lot of legislators being like, if we are going to continue to fund this, if this is successful, which we all should be hoping it is, you know, do we maybe start considering increasing the cigarette tax, the alcohol tax?
Yes,
that was a really real conversation toward the end.
They didn't do those things, but now, in the next budget cycle,
there's a lot riding on it.
And I'm guessing if some non-health tragedy, say a natural disaster, afflicts one of these affected, one of the outlying counties, I'm sure they won't want any state assistance
because it might be a takeover.
I don't wish tornadoes or flooding on anybody, but I do wonder.
Well, with wetlands.
This week, Brad Chambers, the most recent entrant to the Republican primary for Indiana's open governor's seat, became the second candidate to go up on TV with an ad and poured millions of dollars into his campaign coffers to go along with it. Chambers' spot, backed by a seven-figure ad buy, introduces himself to voters and frames him as a political outsider who's never run for office before.
Indiana's great, but it can be even better. Hoosiers need a governor ready to build an economy of the future, a fighter for their values and their paychecks.
The former Indiana Secretary of Commerce also gave his campaign $5 million in the past week to go along with more than $500,000 donated by just a handful of business leaders. And Chambers, a longtime real estate CEO, announced a campaign team of major state GOP figures, including Kyle Hupfer, who left his position as Indiana Republican Party chair to help lead Chambers' campaign. Chris Mitchum, this is a major field of candidates, sitting U.S. Senator, sitting Lieutenant Governor, former Attorney General. Where do these moves put Chambers in that field?
Certainly doesn't vault him into top two, top three territory, but I think he's doing a lot of what you want to see from somebody who has the backing but doesn't have the name ID. How do you get your name ID increased? You immediately get on TV, seven-figure buy, and you start selling yourself to Hoosiers and getting your name ID out there. And one thing I thought that was really interesting in his ad is he didn't even mention IEDC. He didn't even mention, you know, quite objectively, a lot of the successes that they had, $30 million and then $30 billion in investments and things like that. But he really stressed that outsider role. And I think he has the opportunity to thread the needle really well of, you know, you mentioned the staff that he's brought on. It's a lot of Indiana political insiders that have the connections that you need, not only for fundraising, but, you know, what are the best avenues to reach people that you may not, for people who aren't as experienced. So while to the Hoosiers, he can present himself as the outsider, never run for office. He made that very clear. But he has a really good opportunity of, in the background, he has a lot of non-outsider staff people backing him up and really, I think, giving him the opportunity to propel his campaign to the top.
I was struck by the campaign team. Now, this is very much a little more inside baseball, but if there was ever a show on which to discuss inside baseball, it's this one. So, obviously, Kyle Hupfer is the name at the top of the list, and he's very much of the Holcomb wing of the party such that it exists. Number two on that list is Marty Obst, who has been, you know, a key advisor, helped run campaigns for Mike Pence for years since, you know, his re-election run for governor in 2016, 2015. Having those two counterbalances has got us bode well, I would think, for Brad Chambers in terms of trying to appeal to Republican primary voters.
To the extent that Eric Holcomb and Mike Pence pull among Republican primary voters these days, that's probably true. You know, what's interesting about this is the amount of money that's being spent in this primary campaign. It's like having a Taylor Swift concert right in Indianapolis, the economic impact of this. When Pence spoke the other day, he was talking about a divide within the Republican Party between conservatives and populists. In Indiana, it's between the right-wing crazies, which are Braun, Curtis Hill, and now Suzanne Crouch, since she's moved so far to the right, and between self-made millionaires who want to buy the office. Those are the two opportunities within this. It is amazing to me the number that are running, number one, and the amount of money being spent. And I still think, frankly, that despite the fact that Suzanne Crouch has really deviated so far to the right that she's this indistinguishable from every crazy out there, including Banks, still has the advantage if you've got four guys and one woman running.
To that end, you look at the moves that Chambers is making right now. I agree to the idea that this doesn't immediately vault him into that sort of where we think Braun and Crouch are. Which
oh,
is
I
one
think
and
it
two.
Does.
Do you think it vaults him all the way up there?
I do.
Okay.
I think he's got, you know, the team, the money. We'll see what sort of proposals and ideas he has. Obviously, he's introducing himself first before
yes.
he moves on to actual issues and topics.
Sure.
But I don't know how Senator Braun doesn't look at this and get a little nervous because, you know, he's got momentum like I've not seen before in a governor's race for someone who's been in that race for like 20 days.
Yeah. To that end, he gave himself $5 million, which, boy, I'd love
That's
to be able
nice.
To give myself $5
million. You'd even take one.
Yeah, I would take a tenth of that. But he also raised a little over $500,000 from like four or five other people. Obviously, these are
in like two weeks.
Yeah, in like 2 weeks. But obviously, these are people with, obviously, he must have relationships with them. They were ready to do this as soon as he jumped in. But looking at those people and looking at who they've given money to before, I saw Mitch Daniels' campaigns a lot on those contribution lists. Would it be smart for Brad Chambers to establish himself, and could he establish himself as the Mitch Daniels candidate in this race?
And was that a winning strategy?
Is that a winning strategy?
Well, it certainly is a winning strategy. I think, still looking at the general. Of course, you have to get past step
the
one.
The primary. You've got to be the nominee first.
So I think,
but in a primary,
point,
five or six people.
Right. And to your point, I think there is still sort of a critical mass of, heaven forbid this term, establishment. I probably just damned them all. That's not, that's, I can say that on FCC licensed regulated airwaves, right?
Yeah.
I know that's a terrible put down. There still is enough establishment, I think, to have an impact, especially if they coalesce around a single candidate, which is no certainty. There are other quasi-establishment candidates, or at least by label. But you can't be so overt about it. I think that the key here, and this comes into the point made about the brain trust that he has assembled, is being able to make sure that you signal to individuals who might be in that establishment group, the traditional group, the Mitch Daniels group, without offending and scaring or alarming others. And I think that is the challenge. I mean, he's shown, the first commercial was, it was textbook, you know, you show the farm, you show the cutting grass, you show I'm not a career politician. I mean, if you were playing bingo for the terms, you could check everything. What I thought was a deft move, though, was, and this is something that all these candidates will have to address, is you talked about threading the needle, Chris, is that notion of you've had Republican leadership in the state for a long time. So how do you mount a campaign that's normally sort of say, we got to fix this swamp or drain the swamp. So to say, as he did in his spot, Indiana's great. It's a base point. Let's establish it. But we can make it even better.
Yeah, great to greater.
Yeah.
Great to greater.
That's like next level.
Right there. The idea of being a fighter is always really, really interesting to me in this race. It's like fighting... what?
and then
fighting
the question
each other
is,
exactly.
What does he do with Trump? What does he do with the nominee? What does he do with the issue of abortion? What does he do? You know, if he wants to be in the Mitch Daniels area, he wants to steer clear of that. In a Republican primary,
but you don't run there in a public. You don't carry a billboard and run to that direction, even if that's where you're going to end up.
It doesn't
up.
Matter. He's going to get questions about that. Yeah. He's going to have to answer.
All right. Axios, staying on the topic of the governor's race, Axios Indianapolis reported this week that a poll commissioned by Democratic gubernatorial candidate Jennifer McCormick shows her in a tight race or two with some of the Republican hopefuls. According to the Axios story, McCormick's poll of more than 600 registered voters put her in head-to-head matchups with three GOP candidates, U.S. Senator Mike Braun, Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch, and former Attorney General Curtis Hill. McCormick trailed Braun 46-35%, trailed Crouch 39-35%, and was tied with Hill at 36%. McCormick, who served as Indiana Superintendent of Public Instruction as a Republican before switching parties, trails the Republican field significantly in fundraising. John Schwanis, taking any poll paid for by a candidate with an enormous grain of salt, as we always do, looking at all of the people who were mentioned in this poll, is Mike Braun got the reason to be the happiest with these results?
I suppose better to be in the position he's in than second slot, third slot. But going back to a point that Nikki made a moment ago with the momentum she has seen and we've all seen with the upstart in this race, the Chambers campaign, if that, you know, that wasn't really not on the
He hadn't even announced.
He had not, so it was not mixed in.
Not a factor.
So who's to say if we had the same campaign or the same poll conducted now, it would give the same results? I don't know the answer to that, obviously. But I guess to answer your question, better to be first place and the most viable candidate. But you know what? To your point, polls at this stage, we had CNN this week saying Nikki Haley was the only Republican at the presidential level who might be able to beat or at least statistically,
could be Joe Biden.
She won't be the nominee.
And she won't even be the nominee.
Crazy would have to happen.
Well, there's a lot crazy. Yeah,
but there's a long time until.
But that's the point of polls right now. I mean, it's fun to talk about.
If you're Jennifer McCormick, you've put out a poll. You did a private poll that you've decided to talk to at least one press outlet about, knowing that it'll be reported elsewhere. And you're losing by 11 or 12 to one of the front runners for the GOP nomination. Explain the logic of that to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just, in their minds, you know, what a Democrat hasn't won a statewide elected position here in years. And so even if you show them near the top candidate, I mean, definitely showed her.
Oh, yeah, right by Crouch
and
tied with Hill.
So, you know, I think The most I would take from it is she has great name recognition, which I'm not too surprised by. She's our 4 years as superintendent of public instruction.
And
obviously
wasn't quiet during those 4 years.
No, not at all. Well regarded.
So that's something they can build on and maybe fundraise on.
Yeah, to that end, is this poll really about proving to some people who you're trying to ask for money that, hey, I'm in the race.
That's what it shows. It not only has name recognition, but she has positive name recognition. And I think that's something that she can market. The fact that Braun is a sitting senator can get, 36% of the vote?
Yeah.
Okay. Is not an overwhelming endorsement of him.
I think it was more than that, but yeah.
Was it? I thought it was.
I thought she had 36 and he had something. It's fine.
Anyway.
He had a 10.
He didn't have
point.
Over 50.
I wrote this story. It's not like I should remember the number.
Numbers are not our game. Number.
Anyway, my point is that she shows that she's viable and she can raise the money. And we don't know that Braun's going to be the nominee. I've said repeatedly, I think it's going to be Suzanne Crouch, in which case it's a dead heat.
To that point, you mentioned it was too late for Chambers, or he hadn't announced yet before this poll was available, but I really would have been fascinated to see her numbers against like an Eric Doden, not saying that he's going to win, but you have one person with little to no name ID versus you. How do those numbers match up?
I agree.
With somebody that you might not be as familiar, you might not know his political standing as well.
Yep. Yeah.
How do you match up with him? And I think that could have been.
And that would be the same thing with Chambers, because I bet you if you put Chambers on that poll, 10% could
get who he is.
But I think that could have been a better maybe talking point than showing yourself down.
All right, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. This week's question is, can a Democratic candidate win the 2024 race for Indiana governor? A, yes, or B, no. Last week, we asked you whether lawmakers should reconsider their wetlands policy after the state lost 260-plus acres of wetlands since the legislature rolled back protections a couple years ago. 95% of you say yes, 5% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, as students in Indiana begin a new academic year, they have powerful technology at their disposal in some cases. Generative artificial intelligence tools like ChatGPT and Google's Bard. From WFYI's education desk, Lee Gaines explains that this technology may necessitate big changes to the way schools teach and students learn.
Generative AI like ChatGPT can write essays and answer math questions. And educators, for the most part, haven't figured out what to do with a technology that can complete students' homework for them. Kyungbin Kwan is an Indiana University professor who studies AI and student learning. Kwan says educators should teach students about how generative AI works and its limitations.
So let's just understand the mechanism and the principle of AI, and then they can use the AI technology more responsibly.
Kwan says schools shouldn't ban generative AI tools because many students will wind up using it in their future careers.
Nikki, how tricky must it be right now as an educator to decide what to do with AI in the classroom?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how they use it in a way that enhances education. All I can think of is how students can use it to cheat or improve their grades based on that it's not their actual work.
But to the point, you can't ignore it either. But both with acknowledging that our students using it in ways they shouldn't, but also it is the future one way or the other.
You can't ignore it, of course. That would be folly because it is a tool that people, society, including these kids, will be using. I had a great answer that I had asked AI to write, but my phone is over. It's away from me right now, so I can't deliver the great answer. My apologies. Yes.
All right. Finally, a new NFL season is underway. The Colts have a new quarterback, first-round draft pick Anthony Richardson. He becomes the fifth different quarterback to start the season for Indianapolis since Andrew Luck announced his retirement. Chris Mitchum, what is a reasonable expectation for the Colts?
You know what? The Colts can go 4-14 this year. But as long as Anthony Richardson makes a couple highlight plays every now and then and just gets us excited, it's a success.
It's like being a Bears fan like a year or two
exactly.
ago.
Justin Fields was okay, but now you guys have all
and
the
now,
hope in the world.
Now we're ready. Now,
I know.
Nikki, as the resident Bengals fan, what is it Super Bowl or bust for the Bengals?
Oh, for my Bengals? Yeah. I was going to give the Colts maybe a 5-win season.
5-win season.
That's kind.
They may even do better than that. Who knows?
I mean, if Anthony Richardson turns out to be what he could be,
have a winning season.
I mean, the Bengals are a great example to show what
a good quarterback,
that quarterback can do to a team.
Well, speaking of professional football, I just want to. OSU did not.
Yeah.
Speaking of pro teams,
IU,
I was correct last week when I said that IU would beat the spread against the professional powerhouse that is Ohio State.
Just like you, John, broken watches are right twice a day.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say IU's over ISU this week, too.
Let's just hope we can all get
in
a big group hug with Jonathan Taylor before too long. Let's just
say that. Oh, boy, that would make a huge difference. All right, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Chris Mitchum, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at wfyi.org/iwir or on the PBS app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.